Ohio State took a big kick in the teeth, but the Buckeyes are not out of it just yet. I'm Steve Brown, and this is After the Score. Welcome to After the Score, 89.7's weekly look at sports. This week we'll preview the Columbus Crew's big playoff game against New York, a win or even a close loss, and Columbus is on to the league final. We'll also revisit our tour of a Plain City factory that makes baseball bats for some of the game's biggest stars. But first, that collective sigh you heard in Central Ohio around 7 o'clock last Saturday night, that was the wind coming out of the sails of the Ohio State football team. The Buckeyes took their first loss of the season to a Michigan State team that just outplayed them, quite frankly. Here to recap that game is Eric Sager from the OSU football side, 11 Warriors. Eric, Michigan State, like I said, they dominated both lines of scrimmage. OSU only really seemed to be able to pass the ball. They couldn't hardly do that because of the rain and the wind, and OSU just really couldn't do anything offensively.
Yeah, and you know, you don't like to use the weather as an excuse, and I think Urban Meyer said that multiple times on Monday, and then again on Tuesday on the Big Ten teleconference. But you know, he said the whole time it was tough to throw it because the wind was always in their face, and you know how that goes with the coin flip and everything else. And it was pretty miserable conditions with the way that the wind was blowing and the rain was coming down hard. So you know, but when you only get 132 yards of offense and five first downs, it's tough to beat anybody.
So despite getting just 132 yards, OSU still had a chance to win late.
Absolutely.
They punted the ball down to Michigan State's three, and then Michigan State just proceeded to run the ball down their throat to set up a game-winning field goal.
Yeah, L.J. Scott, the running back number three, he's an Ohio guy. He's a freshman, and Mark D'Antonio used his backs perfectly in that game. Scott only had like two carries before that drive, and I think he had like eight on the drive, and he was fresh. He was ready to go, and Ohio State's defense had been on the field for – you know, 30 plus minutes at that time, 35 minutes, and they just got worn out. And you know, you don't like to use any excuse about being tired, but I think Michigan State just kind of, you know, imposed their will, and they made enough plays at the end to kick a field goal and win the game, and that's all it took.
Maybe most surprisingly was they were able to do this without their quarterback Connor Cook, who's probably going to be a first round draft pick.
Yes, when they announced that he wasn't going to play, I really thought that Ohio State was going to win relatively easily, and then their game plan was pretty woeful on offense, and some of the play calling was really questionable, and then the weather didn't help. But D'Antonio, I mean, those two other quarterbacks, they played well. They had a good plan in place, and they were able to execute it. And like you mentioned, the real big reason they won was because they won the line of scrimmage. I mean, plain and simple.
Ezekiel Elliott called out the coaches for their play calling after the game, and Urban didn't agree with the forum, but he basically agreed with the premise that the play calling wasn't very good.
Absolutely. He said on Monday, it's hard to disagree with the kid. I mean, you know, he didn't like how he went out publicly, and he kind of sought out the media, I felt like, you know, because he had told the communications director that he wanted to speak, and Urban was not happy about that. You know, he was obviously emotional after the game. If there was a tough loss, first time they lost in almost 15 months, you know, it's tough for anybody. So anybody's going to be hot. And but Urban said, basically, you know, I can't be upset with him because he does deserve more touches. And, you know, they only ran 45 plays, you know, the whole game. It's hard to win. So Urban said that he's supposedly going to be more involved in the play calling. What that means, we don't know. He didn't expound on it. We don't know if that means it takes away from quarterbacks coach Tim Beck or Ed Warner. But
they do the majority of the play calling now?
Yeah, because Beck has said multiple beginning of the year, he said that he wasn't, you know, the final voice on it. But since he's up in the box, once Urban gained more trust from him, he was the final voice on the call. But how much that changes on Saturday, Urban would not expound much this week. But we'll definitely be watching that on Saturday.
OSU fell to number 8 in the four-team college playoff ranking. The top four teams make the playoff. So they're not out of it, but they're close to out of it. They need to beat Michigan, which looks increasingly difficult, and they need Michigan State to lose to Penn State. And then that way, OSU sneaks into the Big Ten championship game, and it could be a repeat of last year.
Right, yeah, absolutely. They have a chance. It's not as great as a chance as it was because of the loss to Michigan State. You know, they're hoping that Penn State can beat Michigan State in Spartan Stadium on Saturday, and then Ohio State's going to have to beat Michigan, and they're going to have to do it somewhat convincingly. They're going to have to show something, and if they get into the Big Ten championship game, and hopefully Iowa, you know, if you're an Ohio State fan, you want Iowa to be undefeated, so you need Iowa to take care of business against Nebraska on Friday to go into that game 12-0, and if Ohio State plays them and beats them, I mean, that's two wins over top 10 teams right there. So, I mean, that'll help the resume, but it's still a pretty long shot because of the loss.
A lot a lot of things really need to fall into place. Michigan looks pretty good on offense. I want to talk about Michigan in a minute. But I think Iowa, I still think they're basically a fraud at this point. I don't know how on earth they're 11-0.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure they can sneak past a Nebraska team that beat Michigan State.
Right. And they, I was looking at some stats the other night. Iowa's defense at the beginning of the season was playing very well in all phases. And then lately against the run, they've been giving up. They've been getting gashed by some people. So I think they're getting a little worn out. Drew Ott, their all Big Ten defensive end, who's lost to the season with a knee injury. So, you know, they're kind of getting worn down. And, you know, but they haven't lost yet. So they're only one of two teams in the country that hasn't lost yet. Their schedule has been really crappy, frankly. And, you know, the first opportunity they're going to get for a really good win is the Big Ten championship game. But, you know, don't sleep on Nebraska. I mean, they pulled an upset against Michigan State, and they have to go to Lincoln. Iowa does. So it's a rivalry game, if you will, border rivalry, but anything can happen at this point.
So this is about the point where Iowa signs Kirk Ferentz to a 10-year extension, then he stinks for 9 more years.
It adds a couple more million onto that bonus. Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's tied
most,
up there
most
for forever.
Overpaid coaching,
yeah,
in the history of any sport.
I would agree. I just have the fact that the increasing mediocrity that he has had there every single year, and then like once every 4 or 5 years they go and win the Orange Bowl, or they get to the Big Ten championship game, or they want to share the Big Ten before you know the divisions came out, and he would get an extension. So that's the typical Iowa way.
So let's talk about Michigan. They're the best they've been since at least 2011. They have a really, really good defense, especially at their secondary. Yeah. They have a good running back in Davion Smith and a quarterback who's played pretty well.
Right.
What does OSU need to do to beat Michigan?
They have to get pressure on Jake Rudock. I mean, he's been the guy. I was watching some of the tape from Michigan's last few games, especially their game against Indiana. Rudock threw for 6 touchdowns and like 400 yards. I mean, he set school records in that game. And granted, Indiana's defense is pretty porous, not like Iowa State's, but they have to get pressure on him because he has shown, even though he's been playing better as of late, he has shown to make some bad decisions and throw the ball to the defense if he gets pressure. So Ohio State, you know, they got a little bit of pressure on Saturday against Michigan State. Michigan State didn't throw the ball very well, but Ohio State needs to do that. And, I mean, Michigan's got some very capable wide receivers, too, with Chesson and Amari Darbo. So, and Jake Butt, the tight end, you know, don't sleep on him. He's a Columbus kid. He's upset Ohio State didn't offer him. So he's going to have some motivation, just like a lot of guys on Michigan's roster.
Yeah, they're full of Ohio guys. They always are.
Absolutely.
Prediction?
I have said all along that I thought Michigan was going to win, and I'm going to stick by that just because of the way Ohio State played last week. And Michigan's coming in. They've won 4 in a row, and 9 of their last 10, and one of their loss was to Michigan State in the most unrealistic fashion that
muff
I can even.
Muff punt return for a touchdown.
Yeah,
crazy.
Couldn't even believe that. So my pick right now is Michigan 24, Ohio State 21.
Eric Sager covers the Ohio State football team for 11warriors.com. OSU playing at Michigan this weekend. Eric, thanks as always.
Absolutely.
Championship looking less and less likely for OSU. It's looking more likely for the Columbus Crew. The soccer team leads Major League Soccer's Eastern Conference Final 1-0 over New York. It's a 2-game series that uses aggregate scoring, so the team with the most combined goals in the 2-game series advances. The Crew won game 1-2, so even if they lose game 2-1, say, they're still on to the MLS final game. Pat Murphy from the soccer website Massive Report is in studio now. Pat, as we've said, the Crew beat New York game 1. They got their first goal 9 seconds into the game from Justin Merrim. That's one of the fastest, if not the fastest, goal in Crew history, right?
Yeah, it's certainly the fastest in postseason history. They have all season have off the opening kickoff have kind of run set plays, so to speak, to get the ball into the opponent's defensive third and kind of push them back when they kick off first. Greg Berhalter said after the game that, you know, even if you don't score off a play like that, you know, you still force them back, you still, you know, make them defend early, and they've got, you know, guys on the wings and in Merrim and one of the guys, Ethan Finley, who played an initial ball in that, you know, they've got the speed to get down there quickly and stuff like that. So you've seen the team try that throughout the year. This was the first time it was, you know, successful enough to score, and, you know, it was in the net before a lot of people, you know, got to their seats and, you know, the team celebrating. And I think a lot of people ended up missing it because of how quickly, you know, it came.
In soccer, is it the case where a goal like that changes the way the rest of the game is played. I know that that can certainly happen in football. If a kickoff is returned from the very beginning of the game, you know, kind of sets the tone and gives that team an advantage, at least kind of a mental advantage for the rest of the game. Is that typically the case in soccer?
Yeah, it definitely would help. You know, you're up, which right. which makes it different. And I think it changes things for both teams. You know, instead of, you know, you both kind of set off with a game plan and this is how you're going to attack things and whatnot. And when you score that early, even, you know, for the defending team, obviously, or for the team that's down, you know, you now have to push a little bit more, a little bit earlier than you may have expected. But even for the team that scored, you know, you're now up, you know, your game plan changes because, you know, especially in a playoff series like this where the away goals are, you know, as we've talked about, are important, you don't want to give that up. So it changes the way you play a little. You know, you don't, you know, the Crew have not been a team that sits back defensively, but, you know, they don't have to put as much forward, you know, as early because, you know, you've got that early goal.
The New York Red Bulls came into the MLS playoffs as the top overall seed, the favorite to win it all. Mm-hmm. How have the Crew been able to flip this? Is it just with that aggressive play, or is New York kind of downplayed as well, or how do you see that?
Yeah, the Crew did a really good job. You know, they limited New York's chances. Now New York still played well. You know, I think if you know from a neutral perspective, it was a good game because, you know, both teams attacked. You know, both teams played well. I mean, I don't think, you know, despite the 2-0 scoreline, you know, Crew SC weren't they were the better team, I would say, on the day, but, you know, it wasn't so dominant towards Columbus that, you know, it's you wonder what's going on in New York. You know, New York played a good game. You know, defensively, Crew SC were just real good. They kept possession of the ball. You know, they didn't overpossess New York. New York actually had more of the possession, but you know, they limited New York's chances. They, you know, New York likes to press in certain areas of the field and keep you under pressure and force turnovers, and they played out of that well. And, you know, they just came in with a pretty good game plan of how to kind of break what New York does, and you know, it worked out well.
Watching some of the highlights, the environment in Moffray Stadium, it looked crazy. It looked really raucous. Fans were really into it. It helps when you score 9 seconds into the game, but the fans looked really, really involved.
Yeah, and Coach Berhalter yesterday gave a lot of credit to the front office and the way they've sold these playoff games, these home playoff games. Last year, I think we've talked about, you know, there were 9,000 people for the lone playoff game. This year, you know, I think both games have been sold, you know, beyond capacity, you know, 19,000-20,000 people there. So I think the credit needs to be given to the front office for really, you know, getting the word out there and getting people excited for it. And excited, I think, is the right word. You know, both games, the fans have been really into it. You know, the supporter section in Nordeca does a great job of getting there early and kind of creating the tone for the fans and kind of, you know, through the chants and the drums and all that, you know, the rest of the stadium kind of feeds off that. And then the team feeds off, you know, the fans, and, you know, people were there and in their seats, or at least in the stadium. And you could tell, and it was a cool atmosphere, you know, because it was cold, a lot of people were, you know, black coats and things like that. And it kind of reminded me of when Ohio State did, you know, the blackout there, because mm-hmm. it was kind of a neat, you know, you look around the stadium and, you know, it wasn't a complete blackout. People were still wearing their yellow Crew jerseys and
more
things like that.
More scarves too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you kind of get that, you know, it all kind of looked, just was like cool scenically to look around and see that. And then to have that atmosphere and the noise and everything was a really neat thing to have at Moffray Stadium.
Well, knock on wood, if the Crew are able to advance to the MLS final, they look like they're in good shape to host it, since Portland is putting it on Dallas so far in their series, and Portland is a lower seed than Columbus. So if it was Portland and Columbus in the final game, Columbus would host it.
Correct, yeah. Portland beat Dallas 3-1 in the opening game, so they've got a 2-goal lead similar to Columbus. You know, the only difference there is Dallas did get that away goal, which could come into play, and then both games will take place on Sunday. But yeah, it could be very, very neat if MLS Cup ends up being here. They've already announced that they're going to go beyond the normal capacity, add seats to the North End stage if they host it, and, you know, tickets are already going like crazy. So, you know, the demand is there, and people are excited about this team, and, you know, obviously the chance to host it here, you think that gives Crew SC a better chance to end up winning the game. Portland did come in here during the regular season and get a win. So, you know, maybe that throws a wrench in things, or maybe that drives them a little bit more.
Like every boring head sports coach out there, Greg Berhalter, trying to downplay all the talk about the Crew at this point, right? He's trying to downplay how the odds have basically flipped into their favor.
Yeah, we had something on our site the beginning of this week about, you know, the odds were heavily in the favor of New York or Dallas to win. Now Chris sees the favorite with the way things set up, and you know the perception is if. You know, well, the reality is if Columbus goes to New York and you know, doesn't give up two goals, they'll advance. If they score one, New York then has to score four. And so it's going to be tough for New York, but the way, you know, the team is looking at it is New York's a really good team. They were the best team in the league this year, and you know, going home and just needing a win, you know, 2-0 would force overtime, and having overtime at your home field is a pretty big advantage. So, you know, they're not looking like it's over at all. They think they've still got a lot of work to do Sunday night, and the Red Bulls are going to come to play.
The Columbus Crew take on the New York Red Bulls in Game 2 of the MLS Eastern Conference Finals. The winner of that goes on to the final game against either Portland or Dallas. Pat Murphy covers the Crew for the website Massive Report. Thanks as always, Pat.
Thank you.
If you pick up a sports section in Ohio, there's an increasing chance that newspaper story you're reading was written by a computer. The Ohio Associated Press started using computer-generated sports stories this fall, so we wanted to replay a conversation we had when the news broke last spring. Kevin Smith is the former ethics chair for the Society of Professional Journalists. We started our conversation by asking him just how widespread the practice of computer-generated news stories has become.
Well, that's interesting because I have heard about it for quite a number of years myself, and actually thought it might come into play sooner than it did. I think the last time, or rather the first time I heard about it may have been as far as 7-8 years ago. So it's interesting that it's taken this long to actually come to fruition.
When this practice of computer-written stories was really new a few years ago, as we say, there was a story, I remember, about a college baseball game, and the pitcher threw the NCAA's first perfect game in about a decade. And the computer-generated story didn't mention it till about the second paragraph, I think it was. So that's kind of a good look at the flaws of these computer-generated stories.
Yeah. I think that what happens is that the human element is taken out of the story, obviously, because it's robotic-generated stories. So as long as you're dealing with statistics, and let's face it, I mean, the AP generates sports stories that are statistic laden. You know, Peyton Manning threw for 324 yards and 3 touchdowns, and the Denver Broncos beat the New England Patriots 32-28. As long as you have statistics and that's all you want to build on, then these stories are probably ones that you can get by with. But a guy throws a no-hitter, I mean, it's not
a minor detail. It's a big part of the game.
Absolutely. And it's a big part of the game in terms of him emotionally and what that does for the team and that. And all that's been eliminated.
From a journalist standpoint, this is also a bad thing because it's taking jobs, right? These are games that otherwise reporters would probably be covering.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's interesting, I teach a journalism class here at Ohio State University as an adjunct, and I've just finished up the semester. And one of the things I'm constantly telling my students is, you know, executing good news judgment and how you have to inject that human element into that. So if you have someone who is throwing a no-hitter, it's not about a box score. People will go and read the box score, but they want to read about the human element of that. And that's where news judgment comes in. And now all that is stripped out of the stories if it's bot generated.
But conversely, there are some positives to this, right? There was recently an earthquake in Los Angeles, and the LA Times had a story on their website within 3 minutes because it was completely computer generated. So they were able to get this out first because of this algorithm that wrote a story.
Yeah, I don't doubt that that they see that as an accomplishment. I think that you could probably find a veteran AP writer who could write that same story in less than 3 minutes.
Really? Let's delve into the ethics of this. Journalists are guided by a number of ethics, as we know. Do newsrooms just write those ethics now into a computer algorithm, or is there any room for a computer to have ethics?
No. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this this morning, and codes of ethics are written for human beings. If you look at SPJ's ethics code, it talks about things like exercising good news judgment, about being sensitive to individuals' needs, the harm that you do. It talks about avoiding stereotyping. It talks about all these different things that are humanistic qualities. I mean, codes are written for people because people have morals. They cannot be written, or I haven't seen them written, or any discussion of writing them for robots who lack souls or lack morals.
Do you know of any organized pushback against the AP or any other news organizations that's doing this?
No, I don't.
The Ohio Associated Press will begin using some computer-generated sports stories beginning in the fall. We've been talking about that with Kevin Smith. He's the former ethics chair for the Society of Professional Journalists. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thomas, as you know, I grew up in Union County, and I had no idea that there's an amazing company based right in Plain City.
Yeah, and we're not talking about the Dare Dutchman, unfortunately.
First of all, overrated, but I am talking about something else. The Phoenix Bat Company, they make wooden baseball bats.
I until this week, I had no idea there was a bat company in Plain City.
Yeah, it's a neat little place. The factory is tucked into this nondescript industrial parkway. It's just across the Franklin County line. And there's really not much at all to look at on the outside, but the lobby is a baseball fan's dream. Beautiful maple, birch, and ash bats painted, stained, dozens of colors, engraved with the names of all-stars like Robinson Cano, Miguel Cabrera, Yasiel Puig. Jennifer Baxley works for Phoenix, and she gave me a tour. She says the company started in 1996 when woodworker Charlie Thoreau was asked to make a baseball bat.
He was approached by the Ohio Historical Society because they also knew that Charlie played vintage baseball with the Ohio Muffins. They needed a couple of bats for a special event, so they said, "Hey, Charlie, would you just cut them for us?" And he said, "You know, I've never cut a bat before, but I'll give it a try." So he did it, and it really went over so well that all these vintage players who knew him started calling him and requesting that he make them a bat. So at some point, he had so many orders that he couldn't just keep on juggling remodeling homes and cutting baseball bats, so he chose to go into the bat-making business. Hence the name Phoenix. He got started with vintage bats that had not been swung in over 100 years, the models that he was creating. Because when these guys play vintage baseball, they're using bats from the late 1800s. They're playing by 1860s rules.
So these are modern players, right? Miguel Cabrera, Yasiel Puig, Robinson Cano. Do are these bats that you make for them, or that's just their model, if you will? Or why do these bats have these players' names on them?
These are their models, and the reason they're up here is because they have ordered from us in the past. They may not currently swing us, but they have swung us. Puig, I know, was swinging us in the postseason last year. I believe he ordered at spring training. Robinson Cano ordered some at spring training. Didi, who took Derek Jeter's spot with the Yankees, he does currently swing Phoenix. He may swing some other brands as well, but he does swing us. Angel Pagan swings us. And, of course, our hometown favorite, Adam Eaton with the White Sox. He's an outfielder with the White Sox, a great hitter, and he's an Ohio guy.
So players have to buy their own bats? The teams don't buy their bats?
With the big league players, they do not pay for their bats, but the team does.
They order the bat they want, and the team reimburses them or something like that?
The team pays for them outright. Typically, we'll hear from either their agent or, say, an equipment manager order their bats for them, and we actually invoice the team, so the player never has to pay directly for their bats. Big leaguers. Minor league players are a little different story because, of course, you've got your AAA teams like the Clippers. Then you've got double and single and so on. Unfortunately, usually the guys at the bottom are buying their bats. But as they're identified as, say, a top prospect, sometimes the team may say, "We'll give you a certain allowance to go towards your bats." The agent may say, "Hey, I'll buy a couple too," and then the player has to pay the difference. We have split them and invoiced three ways before. That's probably not always the norm. Typically, it'll be they'll have a certain bat allowance, and then they pay the difference.
What does a top-end wooden bat cost?
$110 for maple and birch, $95 for ash. Birch is probably our most durable wood. It's great for the hitter who snags outside and inside pitches. Maple, of course, gives you the best pop. Great for the inside hitters, somebody who might occasionally get jammed. They're going to get the most pop. But then it's the densest wood, so it gives the best protection for the inside pitches. And then ash, of course, has the most flex. It's great for those power hitters who snag the outside pitches and need the bat to kind of have some forgiveness so they're not going through a ton of them.
And yeah, that's really cool that different types of hitters use different types of woods in their bat.
I had no idea. I didn't know. So if you're a power hitter chasing the home run title, I guess you use ash bats. All of that was what I learned in the building's lobby, and the factory was even better. Phoenix sources all of its wood from upstate New York and Pennsylvania. And like we've said, some players prefer birch bats, some want ash or maple. The raw bats come in what the industry calls billets. They're basically like small telephone poles, maybe oversized, unsharpened pencils. You can see a picture on our website, WOSU.org/afterthescore. And these small poles called billets, they come in different weights and lengths because different hitters prefer different sizes. And they're sorted and stored. Even the ash billets have to stay in a temperature-controlled room because they're a little more sensitive. And when they're ready to make some bats, the company workers take these billets and put them in this huge machine. It's basically a big metal box with doors and windows on the side. And inside is a lathe that takes a billet and turns it down into a bat in 2 minutes.
Always when we cut these bats, they've got a little excess wood at either end, unless it might be a vintage bat that's the length of the billet. And there are some that are the exact length of the billet. And now what it's doing is it's starting to sand and go back the other direction. So you can you see that? How the sanding belt's spinning and going down there? It's such a smooth transition. And I'll let you check it out when it comes out. But with all these excess bat nubs, the first thing we do when the bat comes out of the machine is we cut off that excess at the end of the barrel. And we store those in these big metal drums. And we've partnered with a local business in Plain City that has a wood-burning furnace, and it's kind of the core of their production. They'll come pick those up, and what's really cool is no money exchanges hands. It's not always about making a dollar. It's about working with other businesses in your community.
You get rid of your waste, and they get free fuel.
We're helping each other out. And then, of course, we collect a ton of sawdust and wood chips, and we have for several years now partnered with a couple of local farmers. They come and pick them up. There are several big bags of sawdust in the shop that weigh 80 to 100 pounds each.
What do the farmers do with it?
They will use the fine-grained sawdust to sop up spills and then the real fluffy stuff for bedding. And they like coming to us because they know we do maple, birch, and ash. They know that those woods are safe for the animals.
As opposed to walnut.
Exactly, because walnut would cause the horse to go lame. So they like knowing what they're getting. Again, no money exchanges hands, and we were kind of green before green was cool. But we enjoy working with the community, and Ohio Agriculture had taken that tour with us, and they decided that it was a good fit for them, too, to feature the sawdust and whatnot. So a lot of Phoenix product is being featured right now at the Ohio State Fair.
So there you go, Thomas, a baseball bat company that works with local farmers.
Yeah, that's typical Union County.
And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can find all our episodes on the WOSU Public Media mobile app, also on iTunes.
Give us a shout-out on Twitter, @AfterTheScore. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.